I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show, Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to Tampering.
For this beautiful game of basketball that we all love and talk about every single day.
With Sam Panic.
To be able to bring people together.
Reportedly at the center of an NBA investigation
into tampering accusations.
And the message to executives in the league is
stop talking about players on other teams.
What did I do?
The charges filed.
Impermissible contact.
Right or wrong?
Tampering charges are really difficult to prove.
You know me, I talk.
Kind of awkward to even talk about. I can't even mention teams anymore.
Ask me what I like to play with Kevin Durant.
Trial you want with tampering.
They're always ahead of the rules.
It's not rocket science.
Everybody, we don't think I've tampered with the guys.
I didn't tamper. I'm just telling you what happened. I'm just telling you what happened.
Hello and welcome to the Tampering Podcast, part of the Athletic NBA Show Network. Here as always, I'm Sam Amick, NBA national writer at The Athletic. We got two regulars on the show this week. You know them well by this point. Out East, Fred Katz, Wizards beat writer. Out West, Anthony Slater, resident Warriors beat writer. But a new arrival to the show, a man who I haven't seen in person in a very long time, just like everybody else, and it's good to see him here on the Zoom link. Derek Bodner, Sixers beat writer. My guy, we would love to have you on at any point, but your team is looking like a title contender. You got some good stuff to write about. What's going on, sir?
They are not much. Doing well. I think I'm doing everyone a service by not having to see me at all during this pandemic. It's maybe the one good thing to come of it, but I am doing well.
Come on. We were joking off air about the art of Zoom backgrounds, and while super producer Andrew Schlecht is winning the day, you know, you got some stuff going on behind you. You got a little vegetation. You got some art. I see you working there, Derek.
Sure, sure. It is what I have settled on that I don't completely despise. Yeah.
There you go. Well, we're going to get into Sixers. We're going to talk in my neck of the woods a little bit, excuse me, about the incredible Sacramento Kings. I think 7 of 8 at this point. They're on a roll. Is it for real? Is it not? We're going to have a little fun with Andrew's latest segment idea, the pick a side game, talking everything from Miami, Toronto, Dallas, New Orleans, MVP race, rookie of the year race. We're going to make the rounds, but let's start in Philly. Derek, there's so many layers to your situation. I'm going to start with my West Coast bias with the 6 degrees of kind of Doc Rivers impact. And I wonder what your early feelings about the impact he has had. And you know, they go from Brett Brown to Doc, and Joel Embiid is not unlocked, but, you know, kind of in a nuanced way unlocked and in a way that has got him in the MVP race. Ben Simmons doing Ben Simmons things. But start there for me, if you don't mind. What is real and what is not about the substance and the impact that Doc has had?
Yeah, well, I think schematically the changes aren't all that dramatic. You know, Joel Embiid's posting up a little bit less. He's facing up a little bit more. Tobias Harris is getting more of his stuff in early offense. But by and large, I think they're running a lot of the same sets, a lot of the same principles that they previously ran. I think if you looked at the biggest impact Doc has had, it's just a night in and night out consistency that they didn't have at all last year. You know, this is a team that went something like 29-2 at the Wells Fargo Center. They couldn't win at all on the road. They'd go out on the road, and no matter who they were playing, it was almost like they had no shot. And there was an effort level and a consistency that just wasn't there. And so far this year, it has been, with the exception of the one game against the Blazers, where they came back off of a road trip. It was a back-to-back, yada, yada, yada. That was a poor effort. But other than that, they have been focused and giving good effort way more than they did last year. And I think that's probably the number one place I would point to Doc right now. Because like I said, schematically, there's some minor adjustments. I think in terms of that, though, it's a lot more of the pieces around Embiid and Simmons that make a lot more sense. You don't have Al Horford, who I like, but was a bad fit. You don't have Josh Richardson, excuse me, who was a real hesitant outside shooter.
Jason might still be able to shoot, so far, you know what year. I mean? Jason could help.
You could have helped them. But I think those two pieces were pretty bad fits around Embiid. And I think that was a huge deal. But in terms of what Doc has done, I really do think the night in, night out consistency is something they just didn't have last year.
Well, I shouldn't have led the witness. Let me let you grab the microphone. What do you think it is, you know, year over year? Because you mentioned some of the factors there. And outside looking in, the free throw numbers are up, the defense is up. You know, Embiid being healthy and available is obviously a big factor. But, you know that team so well. What has jumped out the most to you?
I mean, in terms of what the success is, and we can go back to what's causing it, but Joel Embiid and his passing and his recognition out of the post was something he just didn't have in prior years. And you could always flummox him in terms of sending double teams. And I think part of that is you had much better spacing than you previously had. Before, teams didn't have as far to rotate over to, the double teams would come quicker. Now there's more ground to cover up, so I think that helps him. But I think the double teams, he has a plan of attack way more than he previously did. And that sort of made the Sixers' entire offense function a lot more smoothly. Like I said, I think Seth Curry and Danny Green have been huge additions in that regard. I think they play off of Embiid much better than they've had probably since the 2017-18 season. But I also think Embiid has just taken a huge step in his understanding and maturity of the game. I think you're seeing a guy who had immense physical gifts, but that understanding of NBA basketball and double teams and rotations and picking that apart, it took a couple years, but I think it's now at a point where it's matched his skill level and talent.
What's Danny Green shooting from three right now?
Mid to upper 30s, I want to say.
Yeah.
It's 37.
Yeah. That's
37.
It's Danny Green season. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's just the supplementary shooting. I remember, was it Seth Curry? He was like over 50% early. I know he had the coronavirus bout.
Before he went down with the coronavirus, which he said he's still like he has fatigue up and down.
Right.
Before that, he was shooting 60% from three. He was on a real tear before he got that diagnosis. Yeah.
Yeah, that changes them. I remember you wrote a story whenever they beat the Pacers. It was probably a couple weeks ago, and I like went in because you had a clip up of Doc Rivers had put Matisse Thybulle like it was like a zone, and he was like roving off the zone. It was I thought it was really cool, like a little coaching wrinkle. And then I just sometimes love going into the quote tweets of like fan bases, and like the Sixers fan base was just like, "This is why we got Doc. I'm sold on the Doc Rivers experience today."
Yeah.
What is the feeling around the franchise? Like, because it's not like the Sixers haven't had good stretches of regular season basketball in the past. Does it feel around there like, hey, like they are much more of a threat as a title contender this season?
I mean, going back to your point, they were almost the exact same 17-17 record at this point last year. And you go back and you think about some of their signature wins.
Hold on, Derek, like don't kill our narrative here. Don't kill our narrative.
Well, we were excited about them last year at this point, right, too. But they killed the Lakers. They killed the Bucks. They killed the Clippers. Like, they had real good wins. It was consistency that was a problem and late season. I think there's a lot of confidence. I think that the narrative this year is different in Philly, in large part because I think some fans had gotten frustrated that Embiid and Simmons hadn't taken that next step. And I think there's so much excitement over Embiid and the fact that he is now not a top 10 player, but a very legitimate MVP candidate. And regardless of whether or not the record was good last year or not, whether it's similar to this year, I think everybody recognizes that Joel is playing at a very different level, that he has taken that step. Like I said, in the understanding of the game, where you feel confident if another team throws their defenders at him and schemes their defense towards him, he's not going to make the mistakes he previously did. I would say the narrative is completely different. In part because I think, having Doc and some playoff success in prior years and some playoff meltdowns, which I'm sure some people will bring up later if it happens. But I think that adds a little bit of stability. I think Daryl Morey adds a little bit of stability and confidence. But I think Joel taking that step is huge in Philly from the fans' perspective, too.
So I fully enjoy watching the Shake Milton experience. When he goes into I don't give a you know what mode, those bench units can be fun.
It's an R-rated pod, Fred. You can say it.
They've been inconsistent though from the bench point. What's the bench? Because this almost feels like we're comparing it to last year. But the vibes that I get are almost 2 years ago when it was like, okay, they need Ilyasova and Bellinelli.
Yeah.
And they get Ilyasova, Bellinelli, and all of a sudden they go on their run at the end of the year, and they have a really nice playoff series against Boston, and they really look like they have a chance. I think this team is better than that team. What's the ideal? I think we probably agree they could use a bench piece.
What's the ideal bench piece? Well, just throwing that out there. I think they could use a stretch 5/4. Like, I think Dwight Howard has struggled here of late. I think he's a tough fit in Ben Simmons, like pairing with Ben Simmons when Joe goes to the bench. So I think that is a very obvious place that you would look. But overall, I mean, you just look at the bench. You're relying on Tyrese Maxey, who's a rookie. Shake Milton, who's played really well here over the last calendar year, but he's still, you know, a third-year player who doesn't have a lot of minutes under his belt. Furkan Korkmaz, who's, I mean, he's Furkan Korkmaz. And Mike Scott, like, you just don't have very many established veterans off of your bench. So I think anyone you can go to and rely on a night-in, night-out basis, almost regardless of position they will look at, I think as a stretch four, stretch five, I think that is a very clear need and something that I think they will pursue. And also just a more reliable guard piece who, I mean, like Tyrese Maxey, I think they're all confident and hopeful of what he can develop into. But he is, I mean, he is a 20-year-old rookie who right now has obvious talent, but is really inefficient as he doesn't draw fouls, really shoot threes. He's got holes in his game that he has to correct before I think he's a playoff performer. So I think a sort of shot creating guard and a four or five that can shoot for perimeter off the bench is their probably primary targets.
Stretch four, stretch five, Sam. Make your Bielitsa case, Sam. I already heard you trying from your Sacramento estate.
Indeed, and I'll table that for a hot minute. There will be no Shake Milton slander, considering I looked at the Sixers lineups, and I think if Doc can just find a way to play that that Tobias Harris, Seth Curry, Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons, Shake Milton lineup as often as possible. It's only 31 minutes, you know, and I'm not a basketball expert by any means, but a net rating of 52.3 is pretty damn good. And, you know, offense around 131, defense coming in, what is it, 79? You know, that jumped out at me when I was looking at the NBA lineups tool. Slater, yeah, I do. Bielitsa is a guy that I'm curious as we, and, you know, obviously Kings forward who's sitting on the shelf and is not even playing right now, a guy who, as we get closer to the deadline, I wonder where he might wind up. It's a little mysterious why he hasn't played. And, you know, and I might have fielded a few phone calls from people who know my Sacramento background asking what's going on there. And, I mean, when he was out there doing his thing last couple of years, that's exactly the type of guy that I think, you know, a high-level team can use as an end-of-the-rotation player and a guy who shoots the lights out, doesn't do much else, but we know the value of that skill. And to your point earlier, Derek, we are already seeing with the work, you know, that the Sixers' new front office did in the offseason, just the incredible benefits of spacing that floor to Joel and the rest of that group. On the Joel front, let's go down this road because we are going to talk MVP a little bit later. Not just MVP and where does he fit and how impressed are we, but the question of in today's NBA, you know, is this the kind of formula that you can take all the way to the top of the NBA mountain? You know, I did a piece last week talking to scouts about the Nets and actually had some material that I didn't use where I had asked those scouts about the Sixers in the context of the Nets and just kind of wanted their opinions of what they thought. And one of those guys had just flat out said, you know, I don't think in today's NBA that you can have, you know, a big like Joel, you know, be your guy. And that's not a championship formula. And others obviously see it differently. Certainly Daryl Morey and the rest of that group. But how do you guys see that?
I mean, he's anchoring that defense right now. For all the talk of what they look like when he's on the floor offensively and how important he is to their offense. And as Derek mentioned earlier, the way he's kind of facilitated out of double teams better. Teams used to really be able to like sneak around that baseline and double him, and he reads that better. I mean, Derek might be able to give an idea of how much that actually has to do with communication with his teammates as well and just general familiarity because they've cycled so many guys in and out of there. But defensively, I mean, the guy has been an absolute monster. And I get the comments about it's harder to win with a big, but I think that's more of a general statement and a general rule we can say about 90-something percent of big men. There are a couple of them who just kind of break the mold. I mean, we saw Denver, which is, you know, a big man-led team, without who, which by the way, Jokic is not a guy who's going to be defending the way that Embiid is. We saw them take down a 3-1 lead against the Clippers team that was supposed to be the ideal team that a guy like that can't defend in a playoff series last year, right? Like there are ways around it. We've seen in playoff series, we've seen Philadelphia put Embiid on guys who more hang in the corner and let him kind of be able to help into the lane. And, he's so talented defensively that I feel like there are ways around it. I have no problem. When a guy is that good, you build around that dude. That is what you do.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned the defense, and that's something you sort of take for granted because he's been so good for so long in that regard. And the change is offense. But yeah, he and that's part of the benefit of building around him is that you can put people like Bielitsa, people like Bellinelli and Ilyasova from a few years ago, and you're still going to have a top 10, probably a top 5 defense if Joel Embiid is on the court and healthy. So I do think they still need one really good creator from the perimeter. I'm not 100% bought in on them being someone that will take down the Lakers or the Clippers in the finals. You know, I think they're still a piece away in that regard. But I certainly think, does Joel Embiid need to be the number one or the number two option? I'm not sure about that. But I think, especially with the way he has changed his face-up game and become a lot more of a, not a pure back-down threat, you know, I think it's going to be much harder to defend him. I mean, the stuff he's doing off the dribble from, you know, his right now his mid-range games is automatic. And the way that's opened up his, you know, he'll go through periods where he's just doing a driving kick game as a 7'2", 290-pound center. That's just like when he's making his mid-range jumpers and he's making good decisions and he's getting the foul line like he is, I think that will translate to the postseason.
85% from the free throw line. That's the number that just blinks at me, right? I mean, because we're talking about offensive forces. Like, you know, you look at Giannis, who will probably be a playoff rival of his. You know, people foul him and they're kind of confident. Hey, we fouled him. He might miss one or two. He might miss both. Joel Embiid shooting 85% on over 11 free throws a game right now. He's at 55% overall after never shooting 55% from or never shooting above 50 from the field. So clearly the shot profile is better and the 3-point percentage at 39%. Like, this is right now, at least through 19 games for him, is like just an absolutely elite scorer.
Well, and he's shooting 64% from mid-range too, which is just, I mean, that won't stay there.
That's like Kevin Durant. Essentially. Right. Yeah.
I think he's gotten better in that shot.
What is
he
overall there?
He's flat out told you, like, he can't be just a back down center. He's said that time and time again over the last 12 months. And I think he's put a lot of work into that face up mid range game so he can be a little tougher to guard, a little less predictable.
And let's not forget, like, the reason people have the bias against the big man is because of the you can potentially play a guy off the floor.
Right.
That in a playoff series with against an elite offense, that's incredible at spreading the floor, and you can play that guy off the floor. But like Derek, and I think you could probably attest, you can maybe dive into this better than me. With Embiid, it's not that he's just great again. He's not the most versatile defender in the league, but it's not that he's just great at the rim.
Right.
He alters shot selection. Like, you look at shot charts when he's on the floor, and it's crazy how different, right, that it is when compared to when he's off. The actual shots they're allowing is just completely different.
Yeah, and there are some matchups, like a couple of years ago against Boston and Al Horford, he struggled at times with their pick-and-pop game defending Al Horford. But they're, quite frankly, just if you're looking at the path through the Eastern Conference, and like if the Sixers meet the Bucks, he's guarding Giannis, and he's gonna, I'll meet you in the paint, and we'll see how I can challenge that. He's probably not guarding Lopez. There just aren't that many big men that I think he really fears right now in his path that can really bring him out on an island. Because it's not just that Al Horford could shoot; it's that Al Horford could shoot and take you off the dribble and make one or two dribbles and make a good pass. He could facilitate the offense out there, and I think that's what causes him problems. And quite frankly, he looks a little bit lighter on his feet right now than he did, you know, two and a half years ago. He looks a little more mobile. He does look like he's in slightly better shape. Everyone says that, but it does look like that is, you know, translated a little bit. He has some versatility. I'm not sure you want him chasing on the perimeter too much. Like, I think he would like to play a little more aggressive of a pick and roll scheme. I think they want to keep him as close to the paint as possible. But yeah, he's not completely lost if he has to move his feet on the floor.
I tell you what, that playoff narrative around Giannis is already tough enough. That's admittedly, that's a matchup I would love to see because I love Giannis's game. I voted for him for MVP twice, but you know, after what happened in the Miami series last year and that whole idea that we have all this evidence of Giannis as great as he is on the defensive end, not being a guy who's interested or seemingly willing to take on those mano a mano type matchups, like the notion of Embiid, you know, getting the best of Giannis in that setting is pretty compelling. Let me push you a different direction, Derek, because on the Ben Simmons front, and I know it's a little harder these days media wise, because we're not around the teams, everything's over Zoom, but you're talking to people over the phone and you have a sense of things. What is your feeling about how he came through the whole James Harden saga? Because to me, that was pretty fascinating. You got Daryl Morey coming out publicly, you know, early on and telling our Shams Charania, you know, that Ben isn't going anywhere. On the back end, you know, just you know, no uncertain terms, the Philly had him on the table, and sure, that was something that they wanted to have happen. But it seemed like Ben rolled with it, and that he found kind of the upside and the silver lining, and they're benefiting from that. But, you know, why are they so damn lucky to have a young star kind of be that amenable to trade rumors, and how did he navigate all that?
Yeah, and I mean, they would have traded him for James Harden. Daryl Morey is, he can say whatever he wants publicly or to Shams. He's, you know, he's playing a part that he has to play. He very much, and look, there was reports from a lot of people that they at one point contacted Simmons, and I think Thibel was the other one, that there was a good chance a trade would go down. So that was, had a chance to be a real tricky spot. I mean, young players of that stature aren't typically accustomed to being in trade requests or trade rumors unless they're the ones requesting the trade. So it was definitely tricky. You know, I think Simmons, he's such a flat personality, and I mean that in a good way. He doesn't go up and down. His emotions remain pretty focused. And I think he probably looked at it and he said, I would rather be in Philly on a contending team than, you know, Houston on a rebuilding team. So I think he probably looked at it pragmatically from that perspective. And I think there is a pretty good bond between Simmons and Embiid. For as much as we questioned it, you know, I think they want to remain together and see this through. So I think I think NBA players to some degree say, understand that's James Harden. Like, of course, they would be willing to trade me for James Harden. And it's tough. I think some players would take that the wrong way. But Simmons is just he's a very focused and flat personality, which is pretty unique for a young player that I've seen. And I think some people will, like, there are consequences that come to that. He is focused to the point where he's not just going to shoot because people want him to shoot, but he blocks out the external pretty well.
How much of the Embiid Simmons stuff from the past was real? And if it was somewhat substantive, you know, how do you feel like it evolved toward the better? Because there was a minute where we were wondering personality wise, sure, if these two guys were going to click.
Well, so they've never really been super tight off the floor. And I think that always raises suspicions. And they're both pretty introverted people. Even Joel, who's very extroverted when you put him in front of camera, but in a locker room, in his personal life, he's a pretty introverted person. So they just never really had like the kind of outings or the behind the scenes chemistry that I think a lot of people would look for. And I don't think that's an issue. I think where the question comes in is if you have these sort of like repeated seasons where you underachieve or there's pressure being put on you, is there enough common bond to persevere through that? And I think that's where some people got rightfully concerned. But I think they are just, you know, Ben Simmons, he's a unique quote unquote star because he doesn't really care about scoring the points. I think he wants to be recognized, but I don't think he needs to be, in part because he doesn't have the confidence to do it, but he doesn't need to be the one taking the last shot, having the offense run through that. And I think that's helped them. You know, I think they both realize that they can win better together because of, you know, how they fit personality wise in that regard.
Right.
It's a good question because there was a real legitimate question to that. I think at times it was probably like, I think we focus on it a lot because it has a chance to completely derail a team, and rightfully so. Like, this is an era of player movement and star movement, so you have to wonder about that. But they were never really at odds. They were just never super close. And I think maybe some of the shared experiences they've had, rather than pushing them apart, have sort of pulled them together.
Well, and it seems, I remember from a couple of years ago, it seemed like in the limited time I would spend in their locker room, there was, you know, it didn't take long to run into the dynamic where you had two young stars that are kind of quietly vying for space within that locker room. And it extended even beyond, you know, there's kind of like how many people do each of them have around them, and you know, all the politics that go on, sure, to the power plays within the NBA. And it does seem like they've worked their way through it. We'll get you out on this, Derek. And you know, since we're going to be playing a game later of kind of pick a side, which is basically, you know, buy or sell. Let's make the rounds with all three of you. I mean, are we buying Philly not only as a good team like they were last year, and like we said, it was playing at a high level, but a team that could be playing into the, you know, the conference finals, maybe the finals, and pushing for this thing? How do you guys see it? Fred, let me go to you.
Yeah. I mean, I told you guys at a pod at the start of the year that I'm buying them as a possible conference finalist, and I think it was Amick who gave me crap. So
I would never give you
crap. Yeah.
You're making our CEO, our CEOs very happy right now, by the way. Alex Mather, renowned Sixers fan, who reads every word that Derek writes, is a happy man these days.
Yeah, no, I'm buying. Defensively, they look wonderful. They have a starting lineup that I think makes a lot of sense, and I anticipate they clearly need to make a fringe move for their bench or two, and they have a general manager who is always president who is always incredibly aggressive in identifying something that his team needs and going out and doing what he can to get it. So I anticipate they will make a move at some point in the next 6 weeks before the trade deadline, or at least in the buyout market, to upgrade that second unit. And I think they're really good. They definitely have a chance at a conference finals appearance.
Slater?
Yes, because I think the East is flawed around them. I don't need to get too deep into my Bucks doubt because I do it every week. and, you know, Miami's the defending Eastern Conference champs. What's their record right now? Like 10-14, something like that? You know, right now, if I had to pick an East Finals, I would pick Sixers Nets. Now, that would be a really interesting matchup, right? Because we're talking about Embiid, the domination of the interior. He would kill that interior, but who does he guard if the Nets go, KD at the five, which I think is where the Nets will probably settle in the playoffs. That would be a fascinating matchup. I don't know who I'd pick, but since I am saying those are my two East favorites, yes, they're certainly a contender.
I don't know how Kevin's going to feel about playing the five with Mr. Embiid down there. That would not go well.
Would it go well if DeAndre Jordan's getting 35 minutes?
I think we talk about the Sixers and adding to the bench. I think the Nets are going to add somebody. They added Novan Leigh today, but, you know, JaVale McGee.
Yeah, the Joel Embiid stopper, Novan Leigh.
No, the one that in that scouting story I mentioned earlier, and who knows if it'll happen. You know, everybody's looking at Andre Drummond in Cleveland wondering if he might get a buyout, and the Cavs have put it out there that that's not happening. And so who knows, as we get closer to the deadline, that's a guy who I think they would love to get their hands
on.
He'd
move the needle. JaVale McGee, I don't think would. But yeah, Drummond's probably the only guy I've heard that might at least move the needle a little.
Right. Derek, you know it better than anybody. What's your verdict here on that squad you cover?
Yeah, I mean, conference finalists, sure, I'm buying that. I still have some reservations about, like I said, actually winning an NBA championship. And this is such a strange year because, like, all of their marquee matchups have been, there's asterisks galore. Like, the two times they played Miami, Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo were both out. The two times they played Boston, Jason Tatum was out. Like, they've only really had one measuring stick game, and that was against the Lakers, and they won it, and that's great. But we have so much less information to go off of this year, and that's probably something we're going to be saying all season. But yes, in terms of talent and fit, I think they are a legitimate threat for the conference finals. Beyond that, I still think I need to see a little bit more.
All right, my friend, it was great to see you, even virtually. Thank you for joining us. Good luck with your media basketball beef happening out there. I didn't end up getting into that, but, you know, the Philly folks know what I'm talking about. But keep up the good work, as always, and we'll talk to you down the road.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Derek.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Gentlemen, let's go from Philly to league wide. I'm gonna kind of wrap the Kings into our pick aside game because
look at this guy hating on the Kings. Look at this big city.
I'm hating
Eastern Conference lover. Well, what does he do? The Kings have their best week in years, and he brings on, you know, Sixers. He wants to talk Sixers.
Hey, go look at my Twitter feed. I thought about it last night. Like my per capita tweeting about the Kings is far exceeds any national writer in the history of what we do. So there's no hate here. You know,
this is your week, then. We should be having a Mega Kings segment.
Well, we should have Jason Jones on then. We'll do it.
Yeah, I mean, well, next week. I'm sure they'll win three more this week. Go to
well,
10
and I'm trying on the fly here. I'm trying to decide who to wrap it into. So if we're picking a side on surprise teams here, I'm gonna crowdsource it. Kings or who? We're gonna start. The pick a side game is gonna be I throw two situations at you guys, and you basically tell me which one you believe more than the other. But who's there with Sacramento right now in the surprise category? Any nominees?
Well, I wanted to do an Eastern Conference hot take of the week last week, but you muscled me out.
You got railroaded. All right. Slater with the floor. Eastern Conference hot take of the week.
Well, it was about the Knicks.
Okay.
And the Knicks have been fun. You know, I've actually enjoyed watching Knicks games for the first time in a while. And they've been playing these like matinee games, which are perfect, right? You wake up, you're like, oh, Knicks are like tipping off right now against the Blazers. Cool.
Right.
And they've just been fun. And to me, like maybe we're doing pick a side here and I'm trying to throw the Knicks into the ring. They're 11-14.
No, that's good.
They're eighth. They're the eighth seed and you know, tied with the Charlotte Hornets, who would be another candidate here. But I think we'll get to LaMelo later.
No, Kings, Knicks. Plus, because you have like the onomatopoeia thing. I like that. All the shared letters.
Yeah,
this
is there good. You go. But like Julius Randle is an all-star right now. Emmanuel Quickley, we talk about Tyrese Halliburton, and we will get to him. Emmanuel Quickley's having like a really quiet, great rookie season scoring off the Knicks bench, so much that I believe Knicks fans are like, you know, really trying to get him into the starting lineup. Thibodeau has sharpened up their defense. I don't know where they rank in defensive rating, but it's a lot higher than last year. They're dangerous. Every game I turn, they didn't beat Miami yesterday, but every time I turn them on, they're in the game. I saw them in person beat up the Warriors, you know, in San Francisco. They're solid right now. Like, they're a tough team to play.
Yeah, I am really curious to see how the Derrick Rose thing shakes things up, because now that he's there, they already have, I mean, I would love, Quickley's playing 18, 19 minutes a game. He's a rookie. It's fine. Like, that's fine. It's not a huge deal, but he is a scorer, man. Like, he is just putting the ball in the hoop every time. And when you're bringing in Rose and you already got Elfrid Payton and you want Quickley handling the ball, and RJ Barrett needs his time learning how to handle the ball and initiate offense for himself. It's like, there's a lot to go around. And that's a team that should be slanting its priorities towards its young guys like Barrett, like Quickley, like Toppin, who hasn't really shown as much as I thought that he would. Even Kevin Knox and even Neil Aquino, who's been the DNP king over the last 4 years, which I'm not all the way out on Frank Neil Aquino yet. I'm just not, because of the way he defends.
You won't give him up.
I will not give up Frank Neil Aquino.
Toppin looks tiny, by the way, on the court. Like, compared to what we thought they were getting like a stretch 4 or 5-ish. Like, I've been kind of a little disappointed from him, whereas their other rookie has been much better.
Slater, just yeah, so you know, the Knicks are sixth in defensive rating. So,
yeah, I mean, look, there you go. Thibodeau, you know, I mean, again, you know, he seems to have a like time span where he's effective, you know, kind of grinding his team. But usually,
he
right,
burns
year
hot.
One, year two, year, right. Yeah, year one, year two, it's like, wow, this team is much better defensively.
Although, I mean, I agree with, yes, he burns hot and he burns people out. I am curious to see the macro here with Leon Rose running the Knicks. He's never had that kind of synergy when it comes to, I mean, I guess he has when he ran his own front office. That's a lot of synergy. But
that
it didn't
well.
in Minnesota. But, yeah, that's a great surprise team, because it is weird to hear positivity around the Knicks. It is weird to also have that within these subplots that we typically are very critical of. The notion of Tom Thibodeau, you know, having kind of the old boys network from the old Chicago days, where he, you know, gets the Derrick Roses and the Taj Gibsons and guys like that. Normally, in the media and fans push back, and the Derrick Rose deal seemed like it had an okay approval rating, and he's getting a little bit of the benefit of the doubt right now.
Just to this piece of trivia is unbelievable. I forget who tweeted it out. Somebody tweeted it yesterday that Derrick Rose going to the Knicks means it'll be the third time or the third team he plays under the same head coach with. So he will have played for Tom Thibodeau in Chicago and Minnesota and New York, which ties a record for one player playing for the same head coach with three different teams.
I have the answer.
And it ties a record, which is held by Taj Gibson, his now teammate.
Wait a minute. Okay. So wait.
Who also played for the same head coach with three different teams, the same three
teams. I believe. Isn't Kevin Martin in that same club? That was the one I was thinking of.
With what coach?
With Rick Adelman. So this is perfect because we're going Kings Knicks. Kevin Martin, who I covered for years and still keep in touch with, good guy. Sacramento, Minnesota, and then Houston. I think, I forget the order, I thought in that club. Maybe I'm off on that. But yeah,
you might be right. Yeah. I got it from Twitter. And as you know, if it's on Twitter, it's obviously correct.
Fair. Well, Kings. So let's flip. Yeah, Kings. I have shouted out Jason Jones a couple times. Kings beat writer had a good piece on Luke Walton today where it's kind of like, it's funny, living locally, the fans are, you know, Luke has had a rough go with the fans and they seem very reluctant to give him any love. I think he deserves some right now. They are playing well. Some of the quotes in Jason's piece last night with Buddy Hield effusing praise about the same coach that he really challenged a year ago and got sideways with was very noticeable to me. They've won 7 out of 8 as of this recording of the pod. They actually have Philly tomorrow and Sacramento. Defense is not certainly on the Knicks level, but they have gone from historically bad, and I just looked it up here, in the 8-game stretch, they have the 11th best defense during that span. So a lot of improvement there. Tyrese Haliburton just looks like an absolute beast. I can't believe he slid to 12, and he was a fantastic pick. Buddy is playing better. Harrison Barnes is having himself a hell of a year. And there's our 6 degrees of Warriors commentary for the day, Slater. But yeah. They got a lot of good things going on.
He's positively looking like Andrew Wiggins out there with his steady contributions.
Indeed.
It's interesting how this is going because, you know, we're talking about surprise teams of the season. The Kings were a massive disappointment 2 weeks ago. I think they were 5-10. You mentioned their defensive rating was, like, worst in history. And then they were on the road and they played some, you know, like, they beat Orlando. It was like, okay, you know, nice little win in Orlando. They beat Toronto. It was like, oh, you know, like, that's solid, but Toronto's not having that great a season. Right. They lose in Miami barely, and then they go into New Orleans. And De'Aaron Fox, who, you know, fringe all-star at this point, has 38 in that game. Some of those closing moves he had to beat New Orleans. It was like, man, that is like a nice little 3-1 end to the road trip. But still, I think at the time I'm trying to look at, they were 9-11 when they win that New Orleans game. And it's like they're coming home, Boston, Denver, and then they're going to the Clippers. Okay, you know, nice little 3-1 stretch. You're about to, you know, realism is about to hit you in the face. And then they beat the Celtics, beat the Nuggets, beat the Clippers. They're now 3-0 against the Nuggets this season. I don't know what's up with that matchup. And then, I mean, for them to go on the back-to-back on the road and beat the Clippers, I'm starting to take notice now.
Although I will say, I got to look it up here and make sure I'm accurate. I'm with you. Very, very impressive wins. Also, a hell of a run with each of those teams, I believe, missing a big-time player. I think Boston, I'll confirm this in a second, was down Jaylen Brown. Denver was down Jamal Murray. The Clippers were down.
Jokic had like 50 or something.
He did. He was a monster. The Clippers were down Paul George. And so they've gotten little breaks like that, but
these are not wins that they were getting in other years.
Not at all.
Like, you know, they're not doing that.
Here's the thing. Haliburton, who we should talk about, he's checking so many boxes. First of all, his poise for his age is incredible. His spirit as a leader is incredible. You watch him closely, and you know there was one moment earlier in the year where Hassan Whiteside got hammered. I forget which game, but he gets hammered on the head, you know, hard foul as he was going up, and he's pissed. And he gets up, and he's about to get a tech, and here comes Tyrese Haliburton, you know, who looks like he's 11 years old, patting Hassan on the backside and in his ear, basically saying, "Big fella, you're okay, you're okay," keeps him from getting a tech. He does that kind of stuff all the time. And then basketball-wise, his fit with Fox is fantastic. Alliteration there, you're welcome. But like Tyrese, and this is not by accident, and I've talked to his people about this, he actually looked at Sacramento and liked basketball-wise how he fit with De'Aaron and very much wanted to come be a part of this group. And that, you know, that opinion, that view is bearing out because all of a sudden with Fox, the playmaking responsibilities are not as heavy. You know, Tyrese can run a lot of that. You know, Fox, I think right now is around 22-6, which is really good numbers, but no one's asking him to be a double digit assist playmaker. And Tyrese is picking up a lot of that. Defensively, you know, Tyrese is slight. He's going to, you know, he's 19 years old, but he is savvy, man. Somebody had a clip the other day where they put together a bunch of video where Tyrese is just a master of laying in the weeds in passing lanes and basically, you know, playing with his eye contact, playing with his body language, you know, kind of duping the opponent into making that one pass that they shouldn't be making. And then he jumps the lane and he's on his way. He's just a smart player and the kind of guy that around here, the fans certainly feel like, you know, they're going to be calling his name for the next 15 years.
He has serious Malcolm Brogdon vibes to me. Like this feels like Malcolm Brogdon's rookie year when rookie of the year was kind of down that year. There wasn't really one guy who we looked at and said, that guy's going to be a superstar. But Brogdon's game was so insanely mature and so NBA ready that everyone just kind of agreed, okay, this is the guy. This is the guy who's at least helping his team win the most. And I know we talked about Halliburton or LaMelo before the podcast. Maybe we talked about it on it. I don't remember. Life is blending together to me. but with Halliburton, for me, it's that you're right. His game is so insanely refined. And the difference, obviously, between him and Brogdon is that Brogdon spent a lot of time in college and was older. And Halliburton, meanwhile, is 20 years old, right? And he looks 20 years old. And he's basically everything that the positive scouting report said he would be, which is why it's kind of crazy to me, and I'm not a draft expert, but it's why it's kind of crazy to me that he ends up falling out of the top 10, because it's not like there's anything here that when you look at the Sam Vecenie or the Jonathan Wasserman or the John Gavoni, like you look at those guys' scouting reports before the draft, and it's kind of, okay, he's going to be a savvy defender. He's going to be a good team defender. He's going to make the right play within the offense. He's going to shoot well on catch and shoots. He's going to be a good secondary playmaker. And it's like, yeah, all these things happened, and he looks spectacular. To me, like, that's kind of, this didn't necessarily come out of nowhere. So it is kind of crazy to me that he ends up being this good right away. And he ends up falling to 12. I mean, good on the Kings, because he's going to be a hell of a player. Well, and
shout out, you know, first year GM Monty McNair. That's a nice win early in your executive tenure. Let's tie a bow on the Kings Knicks thing, since we segued naturally into the rookie of the year discussion. Kings or Knicks? Slater, go.
I'm going Knicks because I think they have a better chance at the playoffs. It's because they're in the East, and the bottom of the East has worse records. But what did I say their record was at this point? 11-14, and they're in the A seed right now. The Kings, it's just more crowded down there. So I believe more in like Thibodeau grinding them to the playoff finish line, where I just think the Kings are going to kind of waver back and forth. And I still probably wouldn't pick them to make the West playoffs.
Freddie?
We're just choosing which team has a better chance at the playoffs.
You got to pick one. One's got to go.
We're just abstractly choosing Knicks or Kings. Yep.
Pick a side.
All right.
Pick a side, Fred.
All right, cool. I'll pick the Kings. I'll pick the Kings because we're not actually picking them for anything.
This
and
New
I think
York
the Kings
hater.
Are
this New York.
And I think the one guy here who's from New York is going to pick that. They're just more fun. They still, even after all this, have a historically bad defense. I mean, they're still 30th in defense right now.
Who?
It is amazing. The Kings.
Are they really?
I'm pretty sure they're still 30th in defense. Like, they still have a historically
your
bad
Wizards
defense
have
after
not
all
taken
this.
That mantle. I saw your Wizards D'ing up the Hornets yesterday. I was like, oh, they're coming for that 30th.
Yeah, I've watched every single Wizards minute this year, and it's spectacular to me that they could not be 30th in defense right now. But I'm almost certain they're not. I think the Kings are really fun to watch, where the Knicks have a lot of grind it out, drag it out.
I've
games.
Enjoyed Knicks games. I don't know. Julius Randle looks like
say
Zion,
that again, man.
Essentially.
Yeah.
All right, Randle has been spectacular.
I'm gonna go.
He has been awesome this year
against the grain. Fred's trying to hate on his home area. Sac's not my home area. I've just been here forever. I guess area. I'm from NorCal. I'll stick with the Kings, if only because if I don't, you know, that neighbor to my left, drunk neighbor John's gonna come graffiti my house if I pick another team. But they are fun. I just, listen, locally, it's wild how nervous fans get when they start getting excited, because they just have been let down so many times. And like Slater said earlier, let's not forget, they literally just lost 9 out of 11 games. Like, that just happened, you know, just a couple of weeks ago. But I like what they're doing in terms of the locker room and the culture, I guess. There was a great clip that I was a little kudos to the Kings' social media for putting out kind of an athletic style salty video clip that had a bleeped F-bomb in it, where Luke Walton in the locker room is talking to his guys, telling them, you know, what they did right that night in the latest win, and then says, you know, we got a Super Bowl to watch, let's get the F out of here, you know. But it just kind of, guys were yelling, guys were feeling good. So the Kings are doing some good things. We'll see if they can keep it up. Let's keep our pick aside.
The Kings, Sam, by the way, are 6/10 of a point per 100 possessions, worse than the Wizards. 30th in defense.
Oh, so you were so close to having to run a correction, Fred. You were close to being wrong.
Alas, if there's one person in the world who knows where the Wizards rank in defensive rating,
Wizards are coming, by the way. We'll see next week. I think I know where that stat man is.
Oh, they're storming. I'm not arguing that's going to stay there forever.
I saw Alex Lynn just locking the Hornets up.
All right, so I got to keep the segue going. But just in case folks listening don't care about the Kings, let's jump to the other Rookie of the Year candidate that we wanted to explore a bit. Out in Charlotte, young LaMelo Ball is playing, you know, some very, very good ball. I hate the fact, I got a quick confession, because I'm not alone. I got to stop doing this thing because it's not fair where you think about a player like LaMelo in the context of, man, that's got to be rough. He's already better than his brother. And like from a human standpoint, yeah, you think about those dynamics. That's not how he should be judged.
And then Sam just says it on a podcast.
I'm getting it out of my system so that I can then move on. Yeah.
Well, you know what LaMelo Ball has? He has Warriors fans a little bit worried right now because he looks really, really good, and that was who the Warriors were debating it to, James Wiseman or LaMelo Ball. We will see. I know we're talking
James.
Tell
him to go cry in their Steph Curry tears as he's dropping 60 right here.
Hey, Slater, you think he'd be this good if he were on the Warriors, though?
No.
He'd be playing so differently.
Yeah. He would be fewer minutes per game, fewer, you know, ability to kind of control the ball. You know, he'd be third guard. You know, he would probably be, I would say he has surpassed my expectations as a rookie. I probably your two as well, where now I could definitely envision him in a small ball lineup. Like the Warriors are playing small right now because all their centers are hurt, and I could see him on that court, and he could definitely ping around some of these passes. And like we talk about some of these newer Warriors not necessarily having the sense of like where Steph Curry always is on the court and missing him on some of his off-ball action. That's the thing about LaMelo Ball. Like he already has like pretty genius level, you know, feel for the game. So there is some fit there within the Warriors. Now, I do not want to get into a debate yet on if the Warriors made the right pick or not. We're talking Rookie of the Year, I think, right, Sam?
Let's get to the numbers because we are guilty sometimes of not giving the listeners the information. LaMelo Ball, 13.8 points, 6 assists, 1.5 steals, basically shooting.
The three-point percentage is better than I would expect.
So 43.6 overall, 30, basically 34 from long range. And what? Go ahead, Slayer.
Well, what's crazy about that is, and this is part of the doubt on him going into the draft, those shooting splits are better than his Australia shooting splits. You know, this isn't Luka Doncic who won EuroLeague MVP, and then it was like, you know, in retrospect, it's like, why didn't you pick him? He just dominated the best non-NBA league in, you know, the world. He was like, LaMelo was like really inefficient and not very good on a like not good Australian team. And now he's, like I said, I think his shooting percentages are better in the NBA through a month.
Halliburton's 12 points, 5.5 assists, 3.7 boards, 1.2 steals, 48% overall, and 44.5 from long range on 5 attempts a game. I mean, that shooting touch is pretty nice.
Yeah, for me, if we're picking rookies of the year right now, I would say Halliburton is a little bit ahead of LaMelo. I think he's been kind of more of a flat line of a season where LaMelo has had his highs and had his lows. And LaMelo's been great, by the way, especially those last 5 or 6 games. He's really hit a new stride. And so if he plays like he has the last 5 or 6 games, if he plays like that for the rest of the year, then we're having a different conversation. But to me, what's absolutely insane, and LaMelo's efficiency numbers are like fine compared to where I thought they'd be at. I thought he was going to be ridiculously low in terms of his percentages this year.
Anthony Edwards shooting like 38% or something.
Right. I thought that's kind of where he'd be, and I thought the three-point percentage would be somewhere around 30 tops, and we'd see some incredible passing and some really good moments, and I liked him as a player, but I just didn't think right away it would be as solid as it is. With Halliburton has the highest effective field goal percentage right now of any point guard in the NBA. Not of any rookie point guard. Of any point guard. And to give you an idea of how impressive that is, number two is Kyrie Irving, who's in the midst of a tremendous season. Now, volume plays into this. Halliburton's not taking the difficulty of shots that a guy like Kyrie is, but it shows how, I mean, the shooting splits are not just really good. They're spectacular for someone who's just a rookie. I mean, this is one of the more efficient seasons we've seen from a rookie guard in a while, and I think that has to be taken into consideration, whereas it's not like he's just kind of benefiting off of spectacular players and that's it. He's doing a lot of this stuff on his own, and with the way he reads the game and just his pure catch and shoot ability, his off the dribble ability, he has been unbelievably efficient inside that Kings offense, and to me that's the difference.
Now, to quote the old Kings president of basketball ops, Jeff Petrie, who I always remember a line Jeff dropped on me. Then he didn't like a story I wrote and said, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. So we got all this love for Tyrese. I was a little surprised to look at it right now, guys. And this is just one analytic, doesn't, you know, not the end all be all, but they're actually slightly better with him off the court than they are with him on. That part,
Sam, diving into the numbers.
A little surprising. The other part that certainly counters that is that their best lineup far and away includes Halliburton, and it's not even close. It's, you know, it's 3x over their second best lineup with any regular minutes. You got Barnes, Rashawn Holmes, Buddy Hield, De'Aaron Fox, and Halliburton. That group, which they've been closing with, has been really, really good.
Marvin Bagley, yeah, I mean, not a part of that lineup, huh?
Yeah, his father's
the on-offs, for what it's worth, the on-offs for Halliburton are tough because he doesn't start. So
yep.
He's going to be playing with reserves more.
Yep,
which indeed. Is on offs.
Playing right, against reserves too. Well, we got a pick, right?
We got a pick. We got a pick. Halliburton or young LaMelo Ball.
Halliburton for now, but if LaMelo, I mean, these last five LaMelo games have been awesome. If that's what he is the rest of the year, he's got a really good shot. They're both really good.
I'm going LaMelo Ball just because I think he's going to win Rookie of the Year. I think he has a higher upside. I think his minute, you know, he's now beginning to start in Charlotte, which is a big thing. The last thing I want to say on Halliburton is imagine if you're the Phoenix Suns watching this. I know we could pick a lot of teams in that, like, maybe 6 to 12 range that should have taken Halliburton before the Kings. How about the Phoenix Suns at 10, who could really use him, who are, like, kind of all in right now, going with Jalen Smith, who's, like, a backup big who's not even in the rotation. I think he's played, like, 7 games, like 4 minutes per game. That one would hurt.
Suns slander from Slater. There we go.
No, I did, right. You know, I was, you know, imagine if you were one of those teams. I mean, he would be right in their rotation right now.
100%. Well, here's the other last thought for me on that front is I keep thinking, imagine being, and I might reach out to him soon, but Vlade Divac right now, because Luka is, I mean, Luka's still incredible, but like some of the shine is off of Luka this year in terms of the Mavs struggling. That's almost the entire reason I felt that Vlade lost his job. And then now you see, you know, how quickly things turn back in a positive direction. Now, again, you got some what ifs in there. Who knows if Vlade would have taken Halliburton and what would have happened. But it's just crazy how quickly things change. I'm going to go with LaMelo. I think, you know, the Slater, the point you make about, you know, the lane he fills and the role he's playing is going to be more reliable for the Rookie of the Year purposes than Tyrese is going to be a big part of what the Kings do, but you know they're moving, they're playing with more parts, so to speak. So I think it's very close though, and I think the winning factor is something that if the Kings are pushing for a playoff spot, then you know I think that's going to help Tyrese quite a bit.
Hornets are in one right now because it's the East. They're seventh. You know that's again when we were talking Knicks Kings. So anyway,
No question. Picking aside, I got the list in front of me here to decide which direction to go. We got into this earlier, but let's pick a side on MVP. You going with, unless we have, you know, like staunch objections to the candidates, but Nikola Jokic or Joel Embiid, and of course we're going to talk about LeBron on the backside, but those two guys, where do you land right now?
I think Embiid because I think they have a clear path to be like a one seed, which I personally believe matters a lot in the playoffs. I mean, we saw
I do too.
Jokic is playing obviously unbelievable, but they just went to LA and like, you know, Lakers kind of beat them up pretty easily. So I think a one seed in the East with Embiid playing the way
they were
he
up
is,
by like 15, 17 in that game, and I looked up and then they were down 15.
It was like the Warriors had just played against the Mavericks, so I was like half watching. But right. I saw it with you. I was like, ooh, good game. Hopefully I can get done and watch the end. And then I get to the fourth, I'm like, Nuggets are down 15 right now.
Right, right.
But I just mean overall, the Nuggets at this point, I think, are probably the fourth best team in the West. And, you know, that's not going to be good enough. You know, I could throw Steph Curry's statistical candidacy into the MVP, but the reason why I don't believe he will be a candidate is because I don't think
he's going to
be
actually,
a top
yeah.
seed.
I mentioned LeBron out of respect because LeBron, his team is, you know, is elite right now. But the Steph thing is real. I just read, you know, Marcus Thompson's column on Steph and just the combination of the numbers that you're looking at and the commentary coming from Steve Kerr and Draymond Green and folks around the Warriors saying basically to the basketball world, like, you might want to wake up and realize, like, this dude who was already a first ballot Hall of Famer is exceeding even his own individual abilities and kind of performance. I mean, Steph has been incredible.
Yeah. You know, I have no problem with someone voting for Kevin Durant, for what it's worth. Kevin Durant has been outrageous. I mean, Kevin Durant's having one of his best seasons. It's right. Kevin Durant, right. And he's having one of his best seasons ever. And I know that he's got two other unbelievable players who he's with, and the Nets defense has been the Nets defense, and they're 14-11.
He's under quarantine.
And he's missing games. Yeah, and he sat for back-to-backs a couple times too. So he's going to miss games, which isn't going to help him. But, oh my God.
His tweet game's MVP too, just, you know, calling the league out. My goodness.
Unbelievable. But he is as good as he's ever been. He's the second best player in the league in my mind.
Well, so to that point, Fred, I feel like we're forcing the pick aside a little bit to go Jokic and Embiid. So let's pick aside there, and then let's do a quick chat about the whole thing, because I think there's, you know, we got to talk LeBron a little bit too. But if we're talking about the big fella in Denver and the big fella in Philly, Fred, which one are you going with?
I'm going Embiid, just because I think the defense sets him apart a little bit. He's so dominant defensively. When he turns it on, it's wild to watch. So I'll go Embiid, but it's really close. Like, I feel like there are those four guys at the top who are all amazing.
Yeah, Embiid for those reasons I said, just because I think Philly's going to probably be a higher seed.
All right, I'm going to, not just for against the grain purposes, but I'm going to go Jokic, because I think Denver will figure things out going forward. Jamal Murray is playing, you know, not like the guy in the bubble. We've talked about that. I think they'll find their way, and what he's doing offensively is historic. You know, it's easily the best passing season we've ever seen from a big man, and then he's out there dropping 50 and doing incredible things. So, you know, yes, where they are in the standings right now doesn't aid his cause. But so, you know, my feeling is that they'll get right going forward. But two great candidates. The LeBron is one that I want to get your guys' opinion on here, because, you know, the Giannis, I feel like it is crazy that Giannis is already feels like he's unofficially out of the race.
We almost can't, like, include him in the discussion. It's wild.
It is wild. And it's also, you know, I thought LeBron was, I understood his kind of reaction last season when he said he was insulted, but I didn't agree with him at all. I mean, I voted for Giannis. It wasn't even close from a regular season impact production standpoint. But now the landscape has changed a little bit. You know, you have, the narrative is always a part of this award. That's just a fact. And the Lakers are coming off the championship, and they keep, you know, not only is LeBron having a great year, but he is yet again, from a leadership standpoint, finding a way to help integrate all these different pieces. You know, they're playing really good ball, and you know, it's not a MVP of the 35 and older crowd, but the fact that we keep seeing him doing the things he's doing at this age, you know, I think he's going to have a really strong candidacy. Where do you guys see LeBron?
He's been good defensively again this year.
Right.
Where it's amazing that after a couple years or a few years where his defense kind of took hits in the regular season, that the last 2 years, I mean, last year he was really good defensively throughout the regular season, and he's been a big part of their defensive success too. I just think he's a big cog in their defensive team. That's where their identity starts. I mean, I know they have two superstars on that team, but that's where their identity starts, and he's a huge cog in that. So he's been good for them defensively. I don't know, he's LeBron. He's shooting 41% from three, too,
crazy.
By the way. That's... And LeBron is shooting 41 from three on like a ridiculous amount of attempts.
Right.
It's not like he's, you know, pulled back his attempts. He's taking deep threes now, which I bet you he's not making those at an incredibly successful rate, because I feel like he always misses those. But he's expanded his range. He's clearly a better shooter. It's like, my goodness, like, is 39-year-old LeBron going to be just an unbelievable shooter? Is that where we're heading to, where he's just going to continue to average 25-7-7 because he's going to turn into an unbelievable shooter?
It's going to be a Tom Brady thing where he adds, you know, four chips on the back end of 35.
It really feels that way, doesn't it?
It's going down the Tom Brady path. And you could tell LeBron, you know, LeBron's tweeting about Tom Brady last night. You could tell he's like kind of watching that. Like,
yeah. I love how he's never shy to self-promote, but he hashtagged GOAT talk. And I was like, we've got a verdict in the GOAT discussion.
So LeBron, by the way, is shooting 41% from three, which is a career high. And he's taking 6.7 attempts a game, which is also a career high.
Yeah.
So it's crazy that we're at that point.
That's what you do when you're old, Fred. You just jack it up, you know?
I know, but the dude is just like, that was, remember when it was like, no, you want him taking that shot. Yeah. And now it's like, I don't know what shot
Mike Brown, anytime you mention LeBron to Mike Brown, Warriors assistant now, he talks about like, they used to go under, when I was coaching LeBron, that was the scheme, go under on him. And now, anyway, what I believe helps LeBron the most in this MVP conversation is Anthony Davis is not really having that good of a season.
Right.
For his standards, he's beat up, his defensive, you know, like disruption numbers are down. He still is an all-star, but he's just, remember going into the seasons, particularly off last year's playoffs, where you could argue Anthony Davis was the best Laker in the playoffs. The thought was, okay, finally LeBron will pass kind of best player mantle on his team over a little bit, be kind of 1B to Anthony Davis's 1A. And I don't remember, I think I picked Doncic for MVP before the season. By the way, that is not going well. But Davis was right up there in my mind of like, I can see Davis having an MVP run. And the fact that he's not having a good season, yet the Lakers are as good as they are, just speaks to what LeBron is doing. And yeah, to me, I might have him one right now over Embiid and Jokic.
25, almost 8 boards and 7, I'm sorry, almost 8 assists and 7.7 boards. So I like LeBron's candidacy. I'm going to wrap on this, but Slater, give us more. We had more pick a sides, but we're going long. We're going to get out of here. But the Steph thing is real. And again, it's a little bit like Jokic. Like, okay, if Denver figures it out, if they crawl their way up the standings, and that's a big if the Warriors can actually, you know, get into a 6-5 territory in the West. That seems like a pretty tough road to hoe. But if they can do that, do you think Steph can sneak into this conversation here?
Statistically, yes. I mean, like you said, he has an argument, as long as, you know, his best argument would probably be, hey, look at that Russell Westbrook season where, what did the Thunder finish that year? Like fifth, and he still won MVP just because of his stats. But Steve Kerr said it the other day, he might be better than ever. The conditioning is what's stunning. He's played every game. He's playing a ton of minutes. You know how he moves off ball, and he is stronger. Go look at his unanimous MVP season. Go look at the highlights when he's hitting the 40-footer and he's as good as any shooter's ever been. He's much skinnier than he is now, and I do not mean that in a he's been eating too much. Like, the guy is built now. He's driving to the rim, and Steve Kerr used the term like fending off defenders better. He's finishing at the rim better than ever. And then it's not like, you know, getting bulkier in the shoulders and biceps has hurt his three-point shooting. The guy has made 25 more threes than any other player right now, at least as of the time we're talking. I believe he's up to 111 already made threes, 43% on threes. I think he's made 12.
How does that pace compare? It's obviously apples to oranges in terms of the number of
402.
Games.
402 was the number he hit on that unanimous season,
right?
Which was ridiculous. Now, again, the fact is we're playing 72 games this season instead of 82 in the NBA, so that will naturally cut down, you know, 10. But I think I'd have to look at what it exactly per game, but it's near that. I mean, he's on pace, I think, to make over 300 in a 72-game season.
I've got it called up right here.
Yeah.
He averaged 5.1 in the year he hit 402, and this year he is averaging 4.8 makes a game.
Yeah.
So, I mean, unbelievably similar.
Yeah, and he's defending well. I mean, Draymond Green mentioned that. He, you know, they're trying to be a top 10 defense, and he's one of their better, you know, defenders, which has always kind of been a knock on him.
Also, an elite shoulder shimmy. He showed that the other night.
Yes. Yeah. The one thing, yes, the one thing that I would say, which is bigger scope from a Warriors perspective, is he, you know, and this is along the lines of LeBron, we're talking about this absurdly extended prime. Steph Curry mentioned Tom Brady the other day. He wants a big, long, elongated prime. And it's starting to look like that is more realistic, the way he has kept himself in shape. And still, he's about to turn 33 next month. He, to me, doesn't look like he's going to, you know, lose much of a step the next few seasons. And that extends a potential title window if the Warriors go all in with some of their assets.
All right, so Joe Lacob likes your commentary. Gentlemen, thank you as always. Fred, we got through a whole podcast and didn't ask you about Bradley Beal and how he felt about his Wizards life. Can you believe it?
Until now.
He went 1-14 the other day. We could pump the brakes for a sec.
Fair enough. All right, gentlemen, you got busy days. Thank you as always. That was fun. Appreciate you. Talk to you next week.